Welcome to Envision This, linking you to visionaries of a more resilient, equitable, and earth-friendly future. David Morgan is here to talk with us about how worker-owned cooperatives can provide a viable and just economy. David co-owns the Toolbox for Education and Social Action, and that's a worker-owned cooperative that creates imaginative and experiential resources to transform the way people think, learn, teach, work, and act. He's currently convening a member council on policy and advocacy for the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, which he's a board member. His vision, passion, and mission to make people's lives more just and democratic through the use of participatory education will shine through this interview. So we're glad to have you here, David, as a speaker, and all of our listeners here, whether live or listening later on demand. Those of you that are listening live right now, if you want to join the conversation, please do so by calling 646-652-2235. Again, that's 646-652-2235. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to speak with you today.
Yeah. It's great to have you back. It's been 2 years since we broadcast The Name of the Game is Coopoly, not Monopoly, with you in July of 2013. And I'm wondering, has our culture made any strides in the direction of cooperative rather than profit-driven monopolies in the meantime?
Yeah, absolutely. So since we last talked, just to use one metric, the Federation, the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives that you mentioned, has grown really significantly. We've added a number of new members. There are a lot of startup cooperatives. There's increased interest in cooperatives across the board. And it's even part of the presidential debates now. People are talking about worker ownership as part of the upcoming campaigns. Mm-hmm. I just saw an article in The Economist, of all places, talking about worker ownership in Latin America, Europe, and the United States as an up-and-coming point of conversation in terms of job creation, in terms of economic development, et cetera. So it really has come to the front of the conversation in terms of economic justice. So it's a very core piece of the conversation now.
How has the Toolbox for Education and Social Action evolved since we talked 2 years ago?
Yeah, we have done a number of things. I should mention that our mission is a pretty lofty one. We're aiming to make everything democratic. We start with participatory education, and we want to bring the experience of learning democratically to any number of contexts, and that will include a traditional classroom, it will include workshops that are held at conferences or in the workplace, like I say, any number of traditional or non-traditional environments. And we want to bring that philosophy to social movements more generally. We're part of the New Economy Movement and many others. And we work in all of those contexts through our philosophy of democratic participatory education. And, of course, we we don't just want democracy to be a limited experience, and we also just want it to be fun, which is why we created Coopoly, a game of cooperatives, and so many of our other resources rely on actually making participation a really enjoyable experience. You know, it doesn't have to be just showing up at the ballot box once every 4 years or so. It's much more involved than that, and it's convivial and, like, can be done around your kitchen table or in your workplace. It's way more enjoyable than it kind of sounds on paper. So in terms of what we've done, we have been involved in a number of different ways in the co-op movement. We've developed cooperative academies where we provide the educational content for startups that are going from zero to launch, and we advise folks who are implementing this curriculum on how to make that democratic and participatory, so the students are leading the process, they're getting what they need to know out of it, and are having an enjoyable experiential time of it. We also work in various other sectors. We, for example, have been working on, I'll mention two different projects. One is the Inside Out program, which is a prison justice organization, and we've been working with them locally on doing food systems and other sorts of farming work at a local jail, and we are developing that system to be productive for folks who are exiting prison and they're, you know, reentering society, and we'll have an easier time of it through what we've incorporated into the curriculum, so to speak, while they're incarcerated. And then another one we're working on is helping independent political organizations in the state of Illinois to get their footing. And that's not a term that will be familiar to most people, but actually the Democratic Party in Illinois said that any new startup parties would necessarily have to join the Democrats. And so that was a bit confusing to a lot of folks on the ground there, and they wanted to form independent organizations, you know, no matter their political leanings, but they wanted to work sort of outside of the two-party system and broaden the political spectrum. And so we're helping them to coordinate that project and get these independent political organizations to have a vehicle for their communications that they can coordinate through, and everybody can get on the same page about it. So, as I say, we work in these various areas that are co-op related and also, you know, social justice oriented in a different fashion.
Right.
I'm just curious, what do you mean by participatory education, and could you give us some examples of how that works?
Oh, certainly, yeah. So, democratic education is our philosophy, and it is one that engages students in the learning process from the start. We begin with essentially needs assessment, sit down with students and figure out what exactly they want to get out of the process of learning, and we share in the administration of a class or a workshop and so on. It's something that they can directly participate in and have some control over. So, for example, we presented, Andrew Stockinger and I, at the Eastern Conference for Workplace Democracy, one of the national gatherings for worker cooperatives, just this summer. And we ran a workshop on democratic and participatory education. And through that, we had the students that were in the room write down their experiences of democratic and participatory education, figure out what it meant for them, what it might mean to apply it in their organization, and then walk around the room writing down information on individual panels that we had set up previously with prompts, their feedback on the content that was generated from past examples of this workshop, and also responding to the other students in the room as they develop their own ideas. So, for example, one organization might say that leading a democratic workshop within their workplace would be challenging for any number of reasons. And another who might have been in that setting before could respond in kind and say, these are the things that we addressed when we were in that situation, or propose another idea. So it very much builds on the knowledge that's in the room and relies on the students to feed back to the facilitators what they need to know and learn out of the process. So there's sort of a cycle, I suppose. There's a way of moving information throughout everybody in the room, and naturally some people will have more and some people will have less expertise in these areas. You know, it's also a way of balancing the power dynamic in the room such that we can share equally in the learning experience.
Wonderful. How do you draw forward the people that are less likely to participate?
That's a great question, and that is largely up to the facilitator. And methods that we use are identifying folks who are typically not speaking, who might be kind of sitting at the periphery of the room or just not engaging as directly and encouraging them to step up. Additionally, it involves encouraging the folks who are at the center of the room, and I mean this literally and metaphorically, to take a step back and not speak as much as they're currently holding. You know, they
yeah.
might be holding more space.
I fall into that category, and whoever is facilitating, you know, has to sometimes, you know, just, you know, either with a slight frown or with bringing their hand down, you know, say, you know, back off a little.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, it helps to have ground rules set and to go through that process, especially if you're working with a new group, just to go through that process together. You know, we want to establish what the norms are, and also as facilitators to kind of guide those towards more just practices. So there's a certain balance that you need to strike, but leaning heavily towards allowing folks who are traditionally marginalized to have the floor, and also just encouraging folks who are in the room and not participating to dive in and to engage with other people around them.
As we were corresponding before this interview, David, you seem really vitalized by the Member Council on Policy and Advocacy that you're convening for the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. What's your vision for this gathering?
Yeah, so the Federation is the National Grassroots Association of workplaces and practitioners who are involved with worker cooperatives. And as I say, it's a member-led organization providing benefits and movement infrastructure for worker co-op movement folks. And this little piece of it is really exciting to me because I think we're poised in a place after all of this energy has formed a bit of a groundswell in terms of attention paid to worker cooperatives and economic justice more broadly. So we've built institutions over the course of decades, and we've mobilized a base that is growing and still needs further mobilization, but we're we're engaged in that work and managing successes across the country, it's really incredible that half a dozen or so more municipalities have passed funding for what they call cooperative development or resolution in support of those initiatives, and that the organizers on the ground are so productive. I mean, they're launching new cooperatives, they're forming networks that are providing technical assistance, they're providing any number of educational resources and so on. So all of this kind of congeals into the work at the Federation to do this policy council. And a number of the folks that are involved in the local initiatives that I mentioned are participating in it. And we're looking to track the initiatives that are succeeding, that are coming to city councils or state houses or even, you know, Congress federally, and to share our information, our knowledge about what works in that context, share model legislation, for example, and also to eventually come up with some identifying factors that could inform a strategy for the Federation for the next 5 years, let's say. And, you know, as a national organization, you can imagine the kind of clout that we might eventually be able to yield at the federal level. I should explain that there's no federal statute for worker cooperatives. There's no existing legal definition. It's left up to the states, and frequently, well, I should also say that only about half of the states have definitions of worker cooperatives on the books, and then frequently they classify under farming cooperatives. I mean, they're not specific statutes to our organizational form. And so with this much energy, I think we can easily achieve a number of different statutes that we can put on the books. We can get funding, and hopefully even we can get a federal statute with the right administration. We could, and Congress, we could get federal funding, et cetera. I mean, the sky's the limit, and we're going for it.
What you just said about funding kind of answers the question that was forming in my mind, is why would you want to bring them involved by making statutes or somehow overseeing it? The funding question, I can really see that would be one. What other positives would there be about government regulation and definition?
Yeah, so allow me to bare my soul here a little. I have come out of the nonprofit world. I watched its development just in the short time that I was involved there, maybe 5 or 10 years, and knowing the history and knowing some of the criticism of it, which is essentially that it was subject to regulatory capture. It was defined by Congress mid-20th century, and the form was defined to a really small degree by the folks that are practitioners. And I see some hope in the fact that we can avoid the same regulatory fate that's befallen nonprofits if we're engaged in this work now. So I encourage folks in the co-op movement to engage with legislators and so on. I mean, frankly, right now we're working at the city and state level more often, but I think it matters that we're directly involved in writing the policies that influence us. And, you know, we're also fortunate that we're at a stage that those still need to be written, and we can directly influence the definitions that will shape worker cooperatives as, you know, as we move and grow as a movement.
And that makes sense.
Go ahead. Sure.
You mentioned right before the show that you're involved in something called Data Commons Cooperative. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is very exciting work. We're coordinating ways for folks in the new economy movement to be on the same page, and we're building tools for them to do so. And what that looks like in practice is developing, for example, ways of mapping who's in a specific geographic area and what the work is that they're doing, or developing databases that quickly and easily allow edits and so on, so that when we need to contact our constituents or folks that are involved in our membership, we have that at the ready. And it's absolutely necessary to be that flexible and to be able to do that on the fly. I mean, I think of these major corporations that have developers and analysts and all of these professionalized positions where that is one person's sole job. I mean, it's a whole team's sole job to develop that sort of an infrastructure. And the co-op movement and new economy movement writ large doesn't have that per se. We have it happening in individual silos. You know, X organization will have access to a certain set of data, and another organization working on the same issue will have a completely different database. So it's a way of getting everybody on the same page to essentially affect change and do it very effectively. And we just launched a fundraising campaign today. It's very exciting work that we've been putting together for a good number of months. And we're very excited to say that we can contribute to that effort at datacommons.coop.
Great. At least you avoid each co-op having to reinvent the wheel and gather their own data.
Yeah, exactly.
In what ways are worker-owned cooperatives a viable and just alternative for meeting economic and social needs?
Oh, that's a great question. It's one of my favorites. I am not even certain where to begin, but one of my favorite reasons is that they build community wealth. And that means that local people can control what happens in their neighborhoods. It means that more of the money that they spend at worker cooperatives and cooperatives more generally stays in their neighborhood. And, you know, there are any number of historical processes that have put communities of color and rural communities and other marginalized folks at the margins of our economy and held them there. And it is vitally important to social justice that community wealth is built, and worker cooperatives and, again, cooperatives more generally are one tool, a really effective tool for achieving that goal. And go ahead.
Besides wealth, does community solidarity gain when worker cooperatives crop up in that community?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. You want to buy me again?
Do worker cooperatives help a community become more resilient, more solid?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd even put that in my number two favorite reason why I like worker co-op. They're much more viable in the short and long term. You know, startup worker co-ops have a higher survival rate than traditional businesses, and that's largely because the folks that are working there also make the decisions about how it's run. You know, they're not going to ship their own job out to some, you know, outsourced company and pay somebody a lower wage to do what they can do themselves and pay themselves to do. Additionally, they fare better when there's an economic downturn, largely for the same reasons that they want to stay in business. They can make more flexible decisions about whether they take less in pay or whether they maximize profit in a certain area. It's a group decision, and those things contribute to, you know, the viability of the business overall. That's a really important factor for keeping wealth in communities and also just keeping people employed. If a boss or a stockholder wants to terminate your job, you don't have very much say in that process, whereas in a worker cooperative, you absolutely do.
Could you give us a couple of examples of communities that have been strengthened by the cooperatives folks have formed within them?
Yeah, certainly. One example that springs to mind is, I mean, goodness, there are several. I'll begin with a more recent and semi-local one. The folks in Cleveland, Ohio have been doing a economic development project that necessarily involves and in fact focuses on worker cooperatives. They've got a farm and I believe they're working on a laundromat as well. They are approaching this through the perspective, through the lens of economic development, and it's already showing results. They're certainly doing well in that community, and the folks who are involved are from low-income parts of the community. They're having a say in their business now and are running it profitably. So those are some of the effects of a worker cooperative in the local economy. And the more famous examples are ones like Mondragon in Spain. You know, the entire system of cooperatives and has sustained that region for a very long time. They have done quite well, fared really well through the recent economic crash and recession, and have minimized the amount of damage that region. It's just the sheer factor of the resiliency of worker cooperatives that they're able to fare so well. And, you know, very smart management and financial regulation and so on that they do within their companies, they're very intelligent about how they have been able to thrive.
David, you speak frequently about facilitating cross-sector alliances. What constitutes such an alliance?
Yeah, so frequently, you know, I've mentioned worker cooperatives, and, you know, those are democratically owned and controlled workplaces. There are also cooperative models that other folks might be a bit more familiar with, like food cooperatives or producer cooperatives. You can Ace Hardware is part of a marketing co-op. And there are a number of forms that co-ops can take, and therefore we need to think about their impact somewhat systemically and think about developing a cooperative economy. And not everybody's going to be a worker co-op, although I wish they would. And I also know that certain forms might be better suited to different contexts. So, you know, if we have a cooperative of cooperatives, that might actually look like a marketing co-op, for example. You know, we share services amongst all of our different workplaces. We share back office operations or advertising as in the marketing co-op, things of that nature. So these alliances bring together all of the different types of co-ops, and it works across a number of different industries as well to provide a bit more structure to the co-op movement as a whole. So you might have a food cooperative, a worker cooperative, you know, a local bar that's worker-owned, for example. And there are a number of these around the country. The Philadelphia Alliance is one. There are folks working on forming one in Boston, down in Austin, Texas. There's another. I keep going. They're all over the place, which is very fortunate. We even have one here locally in Western Massachusetts, the Valley Business Alliance. And that's it's a very smart model for growing the co-op movement as a whole.
Mm. Can you give an example of such an alliance across businesses, across different sectors that you wouldn't expect to be related? Like, I can see shipping and marketing and farming and whatever all coming together around food, but what if businesses are in quite different areas?
Yeah, well, you know, I mentioned the advocacy piece. That is certainly central to what we're aiming to achieve. And if everybody's able to be on the same page about those goals, then all the better. It'll help the cooperative movement as a whole to grow and flourish. I should mention the National Cooperative Business Alliance, or Association, sorry. They are the essentially corollary to the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, but in sort of a more cross-sector sense. And they do international development even. You know, there is a way of extending beyond U.S. borders to use federal funding for business growth in other countries. To answer your question more directly, I think of members of the U.S. Federation as diverse as textile manufacturers, engineers, education outfits like ours. They're tech co-ops, any number of different industries are represented. And since we share an organizational structure and some guiding principles, we are able to shape a vision for what business ought to look like and really what our society ought to look like more broadly.
How do you see the experiences folks are having living out truly democratically run businesses on our understanding of the political democracy we now have?
That's a very interesting question. You know, everyday democracy is quite different than representational democracy as we have in terms of a governmental system. So folks who are engaged in everyday democracy are as varyingly involved with the representational type as I suppose the rest of society is. It is interesting, though, to see when folks engage with local city councils or state officials and so on that, you know, we're able to kind of talk the same talk. We have a shared vision around creating and keeping jobs in our community. We talk about economic viability in our communities, like being able to have mobility and parity among folks in our municipalities. And there are really surprising alliances that form around that. I mentioned the Economist article earlier in our conversation, and part of their description was that left, right, and center are very much involved with worker cooperatives and employee ownership plans more generally for drastically varying reasons. You know, folks on the right find it desirable to have more capitalists. Folks on the left want a piece of the capitalist pie, as they describe, and then folks in the center are just kind of like, all right, great job. So it, like I say, it's quite varied and makes for some really strange bedfellows. And frankly, I encourage it. I think that the more we have of economic democracy overall, the more just a society we can approach. And that's really, really important in terms of, you know, defining who's involved with our movement. Like, we might find that we have a Republican senator, for example, who's willing to sign on to some legislation and, by all means, whatever the reason, willing to further this goal.
Do you see evidence that people are beginning to see through and change the hierarchical structure of our culture?
Yeah, I mean, worker cooperatives, just generally speaking, are democratic enterprises, and most of them, I might be called to task on the actual statistics of that, but I have a sense that we as a culture are more adept at and inclined to lead non-hierarchical organizations. You know, our organization is run that way, and there are certainly many who decide to have management structures that are clearly defined, and that's reasonable, and I even applaud them for doing it because it's done in a democratic way. There's a way of regulating the power and control in all of those organizations that is much more direct than, say, our federal representative democracy. So, you know, as a result, I think we are building a culture, and it's one that tends toward direct democracy. And, you know, frankly, it is one share, one vote. That's more or less the motto of our organizational structure, and that means necessarily direct democracy.
And I think perhaps that once people experience the power of direct democracy in one area of their lives, in the work area, that perhaps then they begin to see how undemocratic the political system is, and how hierarchical it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's a goal for us at TESO. We have a exercise that takes people through the various parts of their life that, you know, it varies from person to person, but they might be in school, they might evaluate the classroom and give their input on how democratic that experience is. And they might evaluate, you know, their economy writ large, their job, their workplace, their political power, and so on. And we ask the participants in this workshop to give a score. I believe it's either 1 to 5 or 1 to 10 of the experience of democracy in all these different locations. So we actually asked people directly, is X setting in your life democratic? And of course, we find that many of them are not. Classrooms especially are not. And that it's our goal to change that.
I had to get out of the classroom because of that. I just couldn't be comfortable with the teacher-centered, dominated classroom, but wasn't in a structure where you could change that. Or if I did try to change it, the kids would see me as soft and then take advantage of that and, take some of their anger at the rest of the system out of them.
One of the questions we get frequently is about how to apply these techniques in traditional settings, and it can be very challenging. There are whole systems in place to ensure specific deliverables from teachers and from students. And this is pretty much an affront to that entire philosophy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We want folks to be involved, and we want them making the decisions about their education. And, you know, a state mandate about X, Y, or Z topic is extremely problematic, to say the least.
Tell us about some of the imaginative and experiential resources that you're producing at TESA that are changing the way people teach and learn.
So we first spoke about Coopoly, and that's a game that teaches folks about, you know, everyday life as a co-op member and owner. And that's since gone international. We're licensing it in a number of countries. We've done pretty much every continent at this point, save Antarctica. But, you know, we're working towards a model for that, where we can be involved with the production in other countries and also allow them a lot of local control over how they implement the game. So what that looks like in practice is working with them on translation efforts, changes to the game that adapt it to local context. For example, we have partners in Argentina who have produced the game, and instead of the point system that we developed for use here in the States, and which was sold internationally, they have chosen to use pesos and put cooperative heroes and heroines on their money. So it has a little bit of this historical context and flavor and culture that, you know, it is specific to their production. So each country's iteration of Coopoly will look dramatically different and be attuned to, you know, local circumstances. We've developed some others. We have a game called Loud and Proud. It's a social justice trivia game, and it's really, really fun to play. We have made it very accessible, and it's not exclusively about social justice history, but is kind of colored with that sort of background. So it's educational kind of by accident. Like, this is a game that you would play in your living room or equally at a political education kind of setting, like, say, show up for an activist meeting and they happen to be killing time or posting this game as part of their meeting. And it's really, really fun. You kind of guess at movie titles, or you guess at books that you've read, or you guess at famous black leaders, you know, any number of topics that, by way of playing the game, you can learn more about social justice history. Those are two major ones. You know, we work directly with clients, too. And as I mentioned, we have done academies and other sorts of curricula that are also engaging and we hope equally fun and participatory and so on. So no matter the cause, really, we're pretty willing to work with folks and to apply democratic education to their mission.
What other organizations or businesses are doing the same kind of work that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Yeah, AORDA. these folks are Anti-Oppression Resource and Training Alliance. Forgive me the acronym if I did. But if you look up AORDA, Anti-Oppression, they will be right there. They're a wonderful outfit of social justice trainers who do facilitation and essentially consulting on democratic and anti-oppression training. They can lead your workshop or provide resources for your organization to be a bit more just in its ongoing practices. And they are lovely. They are excellent at what they do and very much we feel a kinship with them. And of course, you know, all of the co-op organizations that we're a part of, ones that I've mentioned previously, and outside of the co-op world, we work with Jobs with Justice locally. Andrew Stockey, who I mentioned earlier, is a member of the local board here of their worker center, and his programming along with them. I've already mentioned the Inside Out program he's involved with in Chicago. Our other member, Brian Van Slyke, is working, and he's done so much activism. I mean, starting back in the anti-Iraq war days with Code Pink and a number of other organizations along the way. So as I say, we're part of the new economy movement and have this specific focus, but look more broadly to social justice movements and want to be a part of those.
David, what organizations and powers are blocking the work that you're doing?
Empowering what?
What organizations and powers are blocking the work that you're doing?
Oh, blocking.
Yeah.
Great question. Well, as I say, we don't have official standing, and that is blocking us. We're also looking at opportunities to change the limits on access to capital. That's one core issue facing worker cooperatives, is being ready to grow and also to having our model understood and encouraged by credit unions and banks and traditional lending outfits like that. So we want to encourage methods of providing capital to worker cooperatives so that we can grow as organizations and as a movement. And, you know, that will take both advocacy and actual education around practitioner awareness, around the banks understanding us and being able to grant to us and so on. Saying the word grant actually brings to mind philanthropy and the whole apparatus of foundations and so on. You know, these businesses are incorporated as for-profit entities. We're not nonprofits, and so that whole scheme can and cannot apply to us. We need to find fiscal sponsors in order to apply jointly with developers or other allies in order to achieve specific programs, and that can be a hindrance to our growth. So that's a more systemic answer, but changing the way that grant making is done, changing the way that social investment is done such that we can have more leeway with the way that the funds are spent, limits on the return from those investments are important because you're otherwise extracting wealth from the economies that you're trying to serve, the communities that you're trying to serve, and so on. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I'm wondering, are worker cooperatives experienced as a threat to the powers that be, to the big monopolies and corporations? Or do you sort of fly under their radar?
For the most part, we're flying under their radar, but we are so about to change that.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, the project that comes to mind is a cooperative food system where you guys are in Maine. And Cooperative Development Institute has been working on this. They're uniting a number of different producers into a larger cooperative, and it's going to be a multi-stakeholder cooperative with farmers, fishers, perhaps manufacturers, and so on, who essentially comprise a whole food system. And they're going to be making a bid for similar contracts that looks like Sodexo and those large food providers that serve schools and prisons and so on. They claim all of those contracts. So if this is a successful project, and I expect it will be, they'll be able to make a bid for a very large contract in the state of Maine, and to serve the population there democratically and in a way that keeps wealth within Maine instead of going to Sodexo or whoever's shareholders.
Yeah, it's really exciting work that's going on here. And you're right. I don't think that, for instance, the big supermarket chains see it as a threat yet, but they will.
Mm-hmm. Additionally, like, a lot of times it's framed kind of as business as usual because it comprises such a large piece of the global economy. You know, something like a fifth of the world's population is involved in a cooperative, whether they're members of their local food cooperative, whether they formed an artist co-op and own the company themselves, what have you. It is a really, really large part of the global economy overall, and it largely goes unrecognized. And if it were kind of recognized more, and if the philosophy was more widely adopted, then we'd be in a position to to make systemic change, and that is ultimately the goal. We're going for systems change.
Given all that's been going on in both the Chinese market and on Wall Street this week, all the roller coaster business, does it seem to you that economic structure is currently collapsing of its own weight and unsustainability, or do you think it's just sort of going to go on as business as usual?
Yeah. It's a very hard question to answer with any certainty. You know, I am definitely not an expert voice on it. And my own interpretation is that we've been through so many crises before, and capitalism just keeps on trucking. Zombie economy. Unfortunately, I think it will continue to go. And also fortunately, because people's lives are attached to this system at this point. And when the stock market crashes, we lose retirement funds. When our economy overall takes a hit as a result of a stock market crash or other forces, like a housing bubble or so on, people lose their homes, they lose their investment. And all of the traditional structures that we are expected to trust and to abide by. So, you know, I really am loath to say the words that I want capitalism to keep going for a while, but I don't really. I want us to move through it quite rapidly and get out on the other side with a much more just, sustainable, and frankly rewarding system for all of us. I don't expect that it's going to collapse under its own weight. I think we're witnessing the many crises that it produces, and some of us are unfortunately more prone to them than others. And I think luckily we have social movements that are able to respond to those. And like a worker co-op movement has built power to change that. And I very much hope and work toward a time when, you know, we're achieving that. We are. We're currently doing that, and it's astounding. That's why I love this stuff so much. But when we're able to make a really large dent in the economy at large and to transform it.
So you're seeing resources arising that will, you think, see us through any hard times ahead in the transition?
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I think folks are developing, and, you know, historically know how to do this. Like, we're adept. Humans are remarkably adept at providing for one another. And I think that we're in sort of a hopeful situation in that regard. Like, there are historical models that we can borrow from and develop for what's coming. There are current efforts that are making a difference right now. And I, just to go a step further, think that there will be changes to what we're doing now and those historical examples that are totally unexpected. You know, we can fight for something that we want under a certain name, but it comes up completely differently, and then we fight for it under that name and say, yes, this is the thing that we're after. You know, whether it's called, you know, anti-globalization or whether it's called Occupy, just to use, like, two really, really, really recent historical examples. Those are movements with quite similar aims that don't necessarily have that context to share from, but I think are learning from one another and innovating in different ways. And the response to them will produce a totally different outcome than what we are designing from the outset. So it's a flexible situation. We need to be in flux and kind of making decisions on the fly, and it's really wonderful to be so adaptive and, frankly, hopeful. You know, it's
what a wonderful
outlook we have.
What a wonderful note to end on. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
And thanks for the
great
work.
Speaking with you.
Thanks for the work.
Yeah. Thank you very much for highlighting it and for spreading the word. I'm appreciative.
And thank you, listeners, for all that you're doing that that feeds into this. Have a good week, and we will talk to you soon.